Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. My name's Ruth McKee, and joining me today is best-selling crime novelist Jill Perdue, whose latest novel, The Night I Killed Him, is out now with Penguin. I'd just love to know a bit about you, where you grew up and what that was like, what you were like as a little girl, and of course, you know, what your reading life was like back when you were younger.
Okay, well, I suppose I'm a woman who wears so many hats because I feel like I've had lots of kind of different lives. But I grew up out in Rathmichael, very nice leafy suburb, Rathmichael, near Shankill and Bray out there. And one of four kids, kind of in the 60s. So obviously I'm ancient, in the 60s when you could kind of be like feral children. So there was four of us and we were very wild and we were in a big old kind of rambling house because, I may as well out myself now, but my dad was a Church of Ireland rector. So yeah, so my rectory family. So from that point of view, I was always surrounded by words because I was like daddy's little, you know, I just was obsessed with my dad and I would have accompanied him to every service that he did on, you know, on the Sundays. So that was three services. And I'd sit down at the back reading, you know, the hymn books or the Book of Common Prayer and also listening to his sermons. So I suppose I grew up with a huge amount of words around me. And as I say, pretty wild kid went before us. And what I would say as well is that, so my mom was a very, very inspirational person. And again, she was kind of ahead of her time in leaving us freedom. But there were chores and jobs to be done, but you could always avoid them if you were reading a book. So, because of course, there's four siblings. So I've got an older brother, a younger sister and a younger brother. So there's four of us and the boys got the pole positions, you know, eldest and youngest and the two girls in the middle. So there was a lot of, and 2 years between each of us. So there was a lot of killing each other and chasing each other and fighting. So if you were quietly reading a book, mum would leave you alone. And of course there was loads of books because the house was kind of full of books, ancient books and, you know, kids' books as well.
I'm really interested in the Church of Ireland thing and the hymns as well, because I think sometimes like hymns and the rhythm of hymns and ones that maybe stay with you throughout. Can you remember like a favorite one or one that you look, sometimes you would look through the hymn book and go, oh, it's that one today.
There's so many. Now can I think of a favorite hymn? And there was so many, but there's little lines of things like,
yes.
Over the Jasper Sea, you know, so you'd look up Jasper, like, so is that a colour? Is it a stone? What is it? Or you'd have, I mean, even the prayers in terms of and prayers and kind of orders of service. So in the old Book of Common Prayer, I used to think I should do a talk that's called From the Book of Common Prayer to a Life of Crime. But because I used to just read it to pass the time and it was tiny print, you know, and written, God, is it from, God, when, and I should be checking that for my Book of Common Prayer. I think I still have it there somewhere. So this one is from 1960, but like you'd have all the different psalms, morning prayer, you know, oh God, who art the author of peace and lover of concord. So I, at the time, Concord the plane was being built, you know, and I was thinking, why is Concord in, you know, in the book? So you know, this one, like even in terms of clauses, you know, in knowledge of whom stands our eternal life, whose service is perfect freedom, semicolon, defend us all our humble servants in all assaults of our enemies, that we, comma, surely trusting in thy defense, comma, may not fear the power. So you just got to see sentences and words going all over the place.
And that kind of mystery to it as well, you know, the way you sort of understand it, but you don't understand it, but and because of the repetition, it becomes this other thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's one phrase that in one of the prayers, you know, this wasn't from a religious point of view because I wasn't kind of being holy, but it was just the words. There was one phrase which talked about something in newness of life, which means, you know, in the word newness. But there was a girl in my class called Eunice. So I kind of go in newness of life, you know. So I suppose from that point of view, I had my head, my nose in that book with a crazy vocabulary in the Psalms and just the visual imagery as well. Mm. And the rhythm, as you say, of hymns and stuff. I would have had that from when I was probably five, you know. So yeah, so that kept us, that kept me busy anyway. I would disappear into the books and loved reading.
And so then you were allowed to kind of read widely in the house. You were saying your mum, like, if you could get out of doing the dishes or something, if you were reading whatever, and could you read whatever? Were you allowed to just read whatever you wanted?
You could read whatever you want. I mean, I remember an ancient book. I should have brought it. I think I have it somewhere. I had like the Water Babies. Did you ever hear that?
Oh,
That's got the with this little. Is it something about? Now I could be wrong, but I think it is. I meant to check it. I think it might be Charles Kingsley. It was a kind of a Victorian moral tale, you know, and it's a little chimney sweep, and he's been sent up the chimneys, you know, a bit like a Dickens kind of story. He's been sent up in this big old house, and he gets stuck, and he tumbles down the wrong chimney, and he's a dirty little scruffy boy, and he tumbles down onto this kind of white carpeted room with a little princess, and she's in her bedroom, and everything is white, and he, you know, he's not even allowed to step on it, and then. Well, as a child, I didn't realize it, but then they continue. You continue on, and he is reborn in the water as a little water baby. And there's Mrs. Do As You Would Be Done By, I think.
Oh, yes, this is ringing a bell now.
It's such a moral story, and he becomes like, you know, born again, washed again, clean little fellow, swimming, knowing how to be, you know, how to be good. So I'm sure it's like dubious in terms of the horrendous, you know, social mores. But yeah, I remember Mrs. Do As You Would Be Done By and all of that. Like I grew up with a huge amount of that. And that book would have been there. But then the other thing we had, and I loved teaching my little brother to read, we had all those Ladybird books, you know, the Elves and the Shoemaker and Cinderella and Snow White and all those. And the illustrations, I mean, they were just perfect. So I remember the Elves and the Shoemaker was a particular favorite. But as you say, so those would have been there. Oh yeah, and then my older brother, I think somebody had given him these, and to me they had a bit of an illicit look to them because I obviously wasn't really meant to touch them because they're his comic books. But they were the Superman comic annuals, and I think in a way, do you know, at the time in the 60s, girls were still being kind of given girl stories, do you know? But when I read these Superman, like he was, you know, pretty badass, and I love the idea. I love him changing from his Clark Kent with his little glasses and stuff in the phone box to the Superman thing. So I love that as a, I do love a transformation story, and Superman, you know, I love that idea for the action, you know.
But looking back now, do you think that a lot of the books that you had were sort of in heavy quotation marks here for girls at that time? You know, you're talking about the 60s and 70s maybe being a bit, there was a lot more of that, wasn't there?
It's hard to know because sort of later on coming into the 70s, with the sort of TV and stuff, you did have the Avengers and you had Joanna Lumley, was it as Purdy? So you did have this idea of kind of female spies and stuff. And I do remember a doll. So I grew up, there was Barbie, there was Cindy,
Cindy.
who was a little bit insipid compared to Barbie. At
Yes.
least Barbie was kind of badass. But then there was the Havoc doll, Mary Quant. I don't know.
Oh, no, I don't
I'll have
remember
to just look at
this.
it. Well,
Wow.
Havoc, she had, so maybe it was late 60s, early 70s. When was Mary Quant? 60s, wasn't she?
60s, I think.
So, well, I should have checked up the Havoc doll, get a picture of her. But she had kind of like a bomber jacket kind of thing. She had a kind of black suit, and I remember being obsessed with her because she, you know, at that time I used to go around. Remembering now, I was very, well, I had a pen knife in my pocket, and I was really into
Fabulous.
gymnastics and stuff. So I had this idea that I'd be always, you know, if anybody needed somebody, say, for example, to climb in the window or, you know, some rescue to be done, I could do it because I was, you know, fearless. And I was also very small for my age. So I had this idea that I could just be like this little ninja. I may as well out myself for this. So I was the person who took all the putty out of the back window of our classroom. So, the window had to be replaced because it fell out. And I was really just seeing what would happen if, could you take putty out with a penknife? Well, it turns out you can. So, yeah, so I did kind of like that idea. And my mum would have been very feminist. Like she wasn't, you know, she wouldn't have been kind of pressing into my hands the kind of girly things. But that didn't mean that I didn't want to, you know,
Sure.
be a princess, or you know. And one book I did read as a young girl, maybe more around kind of I was 10 or 11, was The Little White Horse by Elizabeth Googe.
The Little White Horse, that rings a bell as well.
Which I
Oh, you
still
have it.
even have it. And in the story, Maria Merriweather comes to Moonacre Castle to, and she's kind of the last of the generation. And basically, it's her job to kind of save it from ruin or from the forces that are threatening. And she comes in her in with her governess, Miss Heliotrope.
Oh, great
And
names.
oh, listen, the name. And you know, and I read the paragraph there of them, you know, traveling in the carriage with Miss Heliotrope and the dog Wiggins. And I, you know, it was like I'd read it. I, you know, it seared into my brain. So, so I loved this, and I particularly loved. I won't read you all of it, but I particularly loved her bedroom because, of course, you know, in a rambling house, I did not have a bedroom like this. So she has this amazing bedroom in the top of a round tower with three kind of Gothic windows, and in each window there's a candlestick, and the door, you know, I'll just describe, the turret stairs ended at a door so small that a large grown-up could not possibly have got through it, but for a slim girl of 13 it was exactly right. Maria stopped, gazed at it with a beating heart, for though this little narrow low door was obviously hundreds of years old, she felt it had been made especially for her. Was more like a front door, like the door of her very own house, silvery grey oak studded with silver nails, and had a knocker made of the smallest, daintiest horseshoe Maria had ever so seen, polished so brightly that it shone like silver. And that's just the door. So you go into the room and it's, you know, everything is silver, and just I just remember being obsessed with that, you know.
Oh, that's just like an enchantment. That's gorgeous. And you probably saw yourself a little bit in there, too. You were like,
Oh,
okay,
definitely, definitely.
I'm that girl who can get in
Yes,
that window. Yeah. Oh, that's
and
just,
to rescue everything. And this,
yeah.
you know, and when my own, I have two daughters, like they're in their 30s now, and they were, I mean, especially my older daughter would read, you know, she was a really big reader. But even with that, like, kids are not going to read that now. The text is so small, you know.
It's so true, isn't it? The whole reading, how, I don't know what it is. I was saying this to someone the other day, that the narratives from that era, they just don't, they don't land, or there isn't the same. I don't know what it is, but it's maybe patience or something. But yeah, and even just that, yeah, that density of text, it's like, wow, it takes you four chapters before you even get to something, you know, vaguely happening.
You know, we didn't, I mean, we did have a TV eventually. I think I remember some specs for the moon landing, but you know, like it was black and white and very small. So for me, you know, for you to read that, you're going to make the effort to read all of that, to get those images in your head. And I think that's what I loved about reading, is it brought you somewhere. So, you know, so I didn't have any other way of getting there, you know. So I think maybe that was it. It's just you work hard because you have to get the image, you
And
know.
it's interesting that those rooms are still there in your mind and your imagination. When you went back to it, boom, there you were. And you saw, I wondered, did you, oh, there's nowhere you can find it out if you saw it in the same way. I'd love to know. Like, you know,
Well,
if you go to, if you know, those neural pathways just light up and the same, it's the same room that you see, or you're conjuring up another one.
No, that's interesting, isn't it? And the whole idea, and the whole idea of reality, what's real and what's not. I mean, that is very real. I know it's in my head,
It's as real as anything
but if
else.
somebody described it, I go, no, that's not right.
Yeah, no, yeah. Sorry, the horseshoe was slightly over to the right, actually. Yeah, that's lovely. And I love new titles. I don't, it's weird because the cover that you showed me there is reminiscent of that era too. And it's like, I look at it and I go, I know that kind of book. I remember that kind of book from my childhood when you took it out, and it's, I can't even describe what even the cover art is in, but there's just something I'm like, I you know, chances are I did read it, because you know, you kind of think, well, yeah, I wonder how popular it was at the time, and were other children reading it, and does someone else have that same room in their house that you have, or in their head that you have?
No, absolutely. And I'm just looking that, so this one was illustrated by C. Walter Hodges, and this one was the fourth impression in 1974. So, you know, I was 10 then, so that's when I'm reading. But it was first written in 1946. It won the Carnegie Medal. So this is probably like the 70s, you know,
Yeah, version of a
an idea of
1946. which was probably written by someone who was born in the 20s with all that history. So fascinating. I'm going to look that one up actually and see if it, so moving on to kind of later, so I don't know if we've, I heard this now, I don't know where I heard this or who you were talking to, but I know that you went to boarding school, and I'm fascinated by boarding schools in general, probably because a lot of us longed to go to one. But what was that like? And what was that like, first of all, just in itself, and then what was it?
So, of course, I had read all the Enid Blyton and the Mallory Towers and stuff, even though my mom kind of didn't approve of those. They were just like, you know, and she did tell me that boarding school wouldn't be like that. But even still, I was shocked and horrified to find myself incredibly homesick. So I went to good old Glengarra Park, which is now a nursing home. And, you know, there were some great teachers. There were some amazing people there. But I was very young to go there. So I had skipped a year in school. I have no idea why you could do that in the 60s, probably class numbers or something. But so I was 11 in first year, 12 in second year, you know, like that. So 16 doing my leaving cert, you know. So,
Oh my
so I was
goodness.
too young to go away, really. And also, you know, as I say, we'd been pretty much running wild, the wild rectory children. We were very good at the kind of pretending to be good when we had to, but when we were back home, we were just wild and nobody, I mean, there was bedtimes and stuff, but vaguely, you know. So boarding school then with, you know, you have a bath on such and such a day and you line up here for that. And, you know, you sort of, I don't know, I just found it very difficult. And I was so homesick at night. I did read to try and distract myself, and I didn't last that long with the boarding. I boarded for the first year, but then I was allowed, well, actually then, well, that's just a whole separate thing, but I became ill actually. And I think now looking back, it was to do with the thing. So I had a tumor then on my leg, and I came out of school and had that removed and stuff. Now I was fine and it was benign, but I look back now and I think, well, that's what happens. You know, I was just unwell, you know, and
Yes.
unhappy. And it did do the job of, I wasn't ever sent back boarding. And my parents, you know, they weren't kind of trying to get rid of us, or I don't. Maybe she wonders now belatedly. No, I don't think so. I think they hadn't been to boarding school, so they thought they were doing this wonderful thing, and you'd be able to do all your after school activities, and you could come out at the weekends or whatever. But it, you know, it is, it's not a place to go when you're an immature little kiddie, you know, and have no idea of that. So when I was there, I did read a lot, and I even see, I don't throw away anything. I read these Sue Barton. So these were now, this is, did you ever hear of Sue Barton?
Don't think so.
So Sue Barton, was, she was a student nurse, and you'd be pleased to know there's seven books in the series, and they were absolutely brilliant. I think written by an American woman, I think Helen Dorr Boylston. So you follow her from her student nursing, the beginning of her career, all the way to, of course, she has to fall in love and marry a doctor because, you know, you'd have to. But it wasn't really written like that. And actually, she was quite, one of the things she was disappointed with was that she was at home then and had kids and gave up, you know, gave up working, but then went back as a district nurse and was always saving people when, you know, when the bus crashed or whatever. So I'm just looking. Sue Barton begins to learn the first important things about the career she has chosen. She has many experiences on and off duty, including getting lost her first evening at the hospital, falling down a laundry chute, her first night duty on surgical ward, and a dramatic struggle with a delirious patient. So these were great to read as kind of, that there wasn't much kind of young adult, you know, because it hadn't really opened up as a genre. There was children's books and then grown-up books. So that was a great one because it was her job, was, you know, I was really interested in her job.
Yes, you almost imagine if that was kind of publicized or marketed today, it would be, and it would be like, this is great to you know, if you're learning about a career and it's not kind of your,
And it was so interesting. And I still remember one scene where Sue Barton, she has appendicitis and she becomes the patient. And she's delirious and she's in a lot of pain. And the noise in the ward and the noise of people coming in and out and checking on her, and somebody knocks against the bed and she nearly passes out from the pain. And I thought, you know, that stayed with me then, that of seeing things, you know, it made her look at her job completely differently. So
that's,
you know,
very clever. Yeah,
it's
a great sort of point of view at that age as well.
Yes.
So I suppose that year for you must sort of stand out, although that year at boarding school must be very distinct for you in your life. You know, it still now feels, when you're talking about it, feels very present.
Oh, definitely. And it's so funny. I mean, I'm a well-known wimp. You only need to ask my family. But things like going out of my comfort zone, including something that should be nice, like going on holidays or bringing my kids when they were small on holidays. Honestly, I could still get that feeling. I could be triggered back to the homesickness feeling of like, everything's wrong. Where are you safe? You're not safe here. What if there's, what if somebody comes into the room? What if there's a cockroaches under the bed? What if all the scary things that can happen when you're not in your own home? And I think, I still have that a lot. One other good book that I have to mention at that time that I read, which was probably the first of the YA books kind of that I read here, you know, coming into Ireland. I mean, I'm sure the UK market, they probably did have YA sooner, but it was The Owl Service by Alan Garner. I don't know if
also rings a bell too. The title rings a bell. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
The Owl Service.
So the Owl Service referred to the plates, a dinner service with little owl motifs on them. And in the story, it's basically a love triangle set in kind of Wales. And it's a reworking of a Welsh legend. And Alison, I think, was the girl. And then there was two boys, one who was kind of the local lad. And he would be, you know, again, I suppose had issues of class and whatever. Alison and the other boy, her stepbrother, were very privileged. So they're young teens, and they basically find themselves reenacting the legend of I think it's a Mabinogion or something, I can't remember what it is. It's an old Welsh legend, but it was quite terrifying because Alison is lying awake at night and her bedroom is under the attic and she can hear scratching of claws. So you have the idea of this owl coming alive, not explaining the plot very well, but basically it is, it's kind of got issues of class, love, betrayal. There's a very big betrayal in it, and a kind of a love triangle, and then all set against, you know, the spooky noises of the owl, and is the owl coming back to get them, or what, you know, is it a good presence or a malevolent one, you know? So that was a great book. Yeah.
And do you think that would translate today?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I think it actually would, but maybe for slightly, I don't know.
Maybe for
a slightly younger audience as well.
Because I'd love to see a list of books like that. You know, we have the kind of list of current books for young adults and for children. I'd love to see a sort of curated list of books from, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, to see what would actually, what they'd make of it as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
There was another brilliant series. I don't have it here. I have, which were by Joan Lingard, and they dealt with sectarianism in Northern Ireland. They were the Kevin and Sadie books.
Oh, yeah.
And there was kind of romance in that. Don't know if you remember them.
So the 12th
of
remember
day of
them,
July
yeah.
was the first one. And then Across the Barricades.
Across the Barricades, yes. Just remember that one. Yes.
They were brilliant books. And again, because, you know, well, this was the 70s. So, you know, there was that kind of stuff, you know, there was bombings, there was a war. And this was, you felt really adult reading stuff like this because they were real issues. And there was also a love story, you know, a kind of a forbidden love. So we've got Romeo and Juliet, but in Northern Ireland, you know.
Yeah. I think they might have been made into, there might have been some sort of vaguely remember a UTV series or something, I might be making that up.
Yeah, no, I think you might be right.
So did you, I know, again, just a little bit from my homework that, and I want to know where this fits in your life. I know that you are, or have been, I'm fascinated by this, a dance teacher. Because you mentioned gymnastics earlier. I'm like, oh, this is making sense. You know, you were like, you were climbing around and you were
with
the patio and the windows and everything. At what point did you get into dance? And how, like,
Well, look, it's so funny because I've been so fortunate in terms of teachers and people that I've met through my life. So I was a wee little gymnast, but we wouldn't have had money to do ballet lessons or anything like that. There was no question of that. But my mum was ahead of her time. So she had started in school teaching gymnastics. She was very fit and she did a teacher training thing in the Amateur Gymnastics Association. So I was really into gymnastics. it was the time of Olga Corbett, you know, so it was like really getting big. And then when I went to Glengarry in secondary school, that was one of the main reasons was there was a ballet teacher there and I was going to join ballet. And the idea was that I would do ballet to help with my gymnastics. But once I met this teacher, the Jill Wiggum, the fabulous Jill Wiggum, who's now back in the UK, but anybody who knows anything about the ballet world here, she was a teacher here and she was just she fantastic teacher, fantastic teacher. So I trained there with her, and of course, immediately once I was in the world of ballet, having come to it from gymnastics, so you had the kind of fitness and you had the approach of basically working hard, and if you fall down, well, so what, you get back up, you know. That helps a lot in ballet if you're prepared to suffer a certain amount of pain. So I immediately kind of raced through a lot of grades and stuff to kind of catch up. You know, so when I was teaching ballet, then if somebody said to me, "Oh, I've left it too late for her to start," you know, she's seven, I'd say, "No, I mean, I was 11 when I started." So if the interest is there and if you're prepared to work hard and if you've got your fitness and stuff, yeah, you can do it. So I loved it. I just loved it for the calmness. And that's what got me through with the homesickness. I think Jill would come out to the school on a Wednesday afternoon, and she describes that just I would just appear. You know, we'd have to in Wednesday, and I'd just appear there, kind of like a little wraith at the back of the room, and that because that was my real escape time, and you could just hide in the music and the work and dance. There's a lot of storytelling in dance. A lot of the dances that you learn for the grades and stuff, you know, you'd be the little girl who's dancing on a beach and her apron is the waves, or there's a story, you know, or the girl who has no friends to play with, or her kite flew off in the wind and she's got to go and find it. So I was very obsessed with the storytelling and the folk tales behind them.
I hadn't actually thought of it that way. You're inhabiting a narrative as well as
Yeah,
an emotion, and you're inhabiting it.
definitely. Definitely. And you're trying to convince somebody of an emotion without any words, you know. And it's very interesting teaching it because you can kind of teach some of it by tricks. You know, you can say, well, you lift your eyes above here and you'll look wistful, you know.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, but you know, exactly. You see, or here's all the tricks now, or you put your head down, eyes up, and you look like, don't mess with me, you know. So you can teach tricks, but sometimes. And you see this a lot when you're teaching the little ones because they're just in a story, you know. There was one group, and actually my own daughter was in this group. I used to do a dance where we were taking our little puppy out for a walk in the park, and he slipped off his lead, and you have a long time looking for the puppy, and you're really upset, and then you find him under a bench, right? I mean, obviously you find him, but some of the children, the particularly sensitive ones, were just too brokenhearted even to do the bit where they've lost the puppy, even though we skip out. So,
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, I can totally
look
get
at.
that. They're like, it's too
And
much.
then I knew it was time to retire. I used to do this one with my dancers will remember this. I used to do one where they were all being fairies, but obviously that wasn't enough excitement going on in my life as a thriller writer. So there was the witch and the rescue fairies. So there's an evil witch has put half of the class, you know, under a spell and they're fast asleep.
Yeah.
And I'd be the evil witch, obviously, clearly. And then the rescue fairies, they're invisible to the witch's eyesight is really bad. They're invisible if they're quiet. So they fly around and they wave their magic wands and free them from the spell, which was, you know, it's a good, yeah, 2 minutes flat. It's a good little dance. But again, you'd often have a couple of children who are just too terrified of the witch, you know. Or and then the older I got, I thought, well, no, Jill, you can't be the witch anymore because unfortunately, you know, they think you are a witch. So that one bit the dust. But yeah, no, dance was always part of my life. So I left Glengarry and I did my final 2 years somewhere else, and I was boarding there and I was really, really happy. I was in Columbus my last 2 years, which was again, it's very beautiful, beautiful school, and such, you know, privilege to be there. At that point, I had to kind of keep up the ballet, so I had to kind of come in and out, get 2 buses down to Rathmines and try and keep it going. But I never let it go because it was just, it saved my sanity. In terms of could I go off and do dancing? There was no question. I mean, I did want to, I would have loved to have been a dancer, a writer or a teacher, all the things I wanted to be and all the things I ended up being. But there was
Yes.
no question of being able to go over to ballet school aged, you know, in 1979, 81 actually was the year I left school. So there was, you know, there was a recession, whatever. So
Oh man.
my dad packed me off to teacher training college, which I enjoyed and I loved the teaching, but those are that's the reality, I suppose,
That is the reality for a lot of people, isn't it? But doesn't make it any easier to swallow. And so you were teacher training, and did you, what was your subject then?
So in teacher training, it was a college of it was for primary school
For
teaching.
primary
So
school,
it's like there
okay.
was Preble and there was, there's Preble and St Pat's, and then this was CICE in Rathmines, which was was a small college. So there was only like 20 in each year, and it was affiliated to Trinity. So it was kind of funny though, because in a way you're saying you're in Trinity, but you weren't in Trinity, not really. I mean, you went in one day a week, but you had to live in the college in first year when I was there. So
Okay.
we won't do any comments on my wild time in teacher training college. I'm
You
sure there
sure?
are lecturers still alive, well alive, who are just thinking, yeah, I wish you'd gone off to ballet school, actually. So,
And so were you like, was reading still important to you then? Did it sort of take a back seat for a while, like it does with some people around that time, or?
It did. It did. I was trying to think with the college years, and the only thing I could think of, the two books that kind of at both ends of the spectrum. So, although I was the one of the, I must say, one of the absolute just fantastic thing out of my life was, we were lectured by the late great Robert Dunbar in
Oh,
teacher
wow.
training in CICE. He was a lecturer there. So that was just so fantastic, the world of children's literature. And to be writing essays for him and to be discussing teaching of English with him was just brilliant. So so I was delighted that I went there in the end. But I remember we had, the book was called The Guide to Teaching Practice by Cohen and Mannion, which was this handbook of like supposedly all this practical information that you would need for teacher training college, and I'm sure it is, but like all these things, you learn more in the first 10 minutes when you're standing in front of a class than anything you ever learned, practically. And the other book I came across at that point was a psychology, I suppose a psychology book by Bruno Bettelheim called The Meaning and Importance of Fairy Tales. And that book, I came back to again and again. I have it here. I think written in the 60s. It goes through all the well-known fairy tales and some of the more obscure ones, and basically discusses them as what they were, which were, they were kind of guidelines for living for people. They were, trying to, he kind of decodes their psychological meaning. So I was very interested in that. So even for things like, I'm thinking even something like Beauty and the Beast, it's a sort of a, it was, if you like, a kind of a moral tale for the girl of, be patient, and if you do your job right, you'll turn that beast into a lovely prince, or Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs apparently is to do, again, it's supposed to be with a kind of a girl learning her place in home, and where she has to kind of mind all the little men, and then everything will be all right. Sleeping Beauty was an interesting one because it's supposed to be that girls can go through this very kind of, I suppose, kind of placid, not that bit time when they're kind of checked out. They're not really, they haven't kind of seized the reins of their lives, and so anybody who's ever watched their teenage daughters sleep through their teens might be interested to look at that one. But it was a very interesting book, Bruno Bettelheim's Tour of Fairy Stories with All Their Psychoanalytic Connotations Brought Out into the Open, is a feast of understanding, says Richard Thorne in New Society.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I'm endlessly interested in fairy tales and how they kind of lodge in our psyche. And so,
Definitely.
particularly the moral, but yeah, there's definitely a theme. There's a
And
theme going through those, but yeah, sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say I sort of talked about two girls one, but like things like Jack and the Beanstalk, about a boy coming into, and sort of supplanting his father, and Cinderella, I suppose, again, a transformation story that, suffering, you'll be rewarded in the end. Or in a lot of those stories, kindness to other people is rewarded, or patience is rewarded, or just to give you, or even the Ugly Duckling,
You like the
another.
transformation stories, we know that. But or some of them that don't even seem, you sort of think, God, that's just actually really, really malevolent, and there isn't a moral message. Or I was talking to my daughter Lucy about this. We were trying to figure out, well, even with the red shoes, which has so many different connotations, and talking to Eilish Nguibne the other day, one of the last stories in her collection of selected stories is a sort of a Red Riding Hood one, and it actually just kind of it's a really, I would recommend that story to you actually, because it kind of explores the story in the story itself about Little Red Riding Hood, and it sort of asks the question, well, what do you want at the end of the story? Is this not good enough for you? You want the moral, or do you want the bad ending, or do you want the nice neat? And as a crime writer, I suppose this is a good question
That's
for you.
what I,
What kind of an ending do you want? Do you want everyone to feel better at the end? Do you want them to, look into the void and question their own existence? Do you want to make them feel better, or do you want to expose something, or like what?
I suppose for me, I don't know. It's, I mean, I'm kind of maybe giving too much attention to transformation stories because I do like them, but that's not what I write. I do like a bit of revenge, and I do like a story of escape, escape from a bully, escape from a terrible situation, escape from your own from a prison of the of your own making of guilt and sadness, and grief, kind of. So I love an escape story. There was one of the fairy stories, which was The Wolf and the Seven Little Kids. And do you know that one when the mummy goat goes out and she says to her little kid, "Do not
Oh,
open the door to the wolf."
yes,
And
I
the
do
wolf
know that one.
tricks his way in. He paints his paws white to look like the mum's hooves. He tricks his way in. He eats all the six of them except for the littlest one. And he then goes out and falls asleep under a tree, and mummy comes back and is horrified that all her little kids are gone except one. So the little kid shows where they are and where the wolf is asleep, and they cut him open. I love a grisly one. They cut him open, take out the thing, and filled his stomach with rocks. And then he wakes up, bit of a hangover, I had too much. Makes his way to get a drink of water in the river and falls in and drowns. I did love that one. I mean,
Oh
how
yeah,
vicious is that?
that is very satisfying, isn't it? And there was a lot of cutting open in fairy tales. I'm just thinking, yeah, there was like the big bad wolf was cut open, and out popped Granny, well, in one of the versions. But yeah, there's a lot of disemboweling, and but yeah, comeuppance, proper good old,
Proper comeuppance. And
and
I
then
love
some.
the I love the kind of I love the fact that the mummy goat, takes out her needle and thread then and kind of sews them up. And I love the fact that he the his ending properly befits the depth of his crime, to pretend to be a mummy. I mean, I remember being horrified that he, the deception involved, and the idiots opening the door. So those are those are very high stake stories, and anybody who reads any of my three kind of adult crime ones, I do like a bit of an overheated ending. I like
Yes, well, I was
those.
about to say, The Night I Killed Him, well, you've touched on an awful lot of the kind of themes that are in that, and deception particularly. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. It was one of the themes that I really liked, was the kind of duplicity, I suppose. But yes, there's also, we can't give away the ending, but the ending is tremendously satisfying.
Well, thank you.
And
Keep
well, we'll
it on
keep,
your
no, I'm
toes.
not going to talk about the ending, don't worry. We'll get to that in a second. I want to ask you just a couple more book choices before we get to The Night I Killed Him.
No, I should say I'll give you some light warm up. I did read a lot of P.G. Woodhouse, the Jeeves and Wooster, because I do humor is very important to me, and if you see from the stories, Neve gets all the funny stuff. But the Jeeves and Wooster, I love the interplay between the two of them, and I love the language. So there was that. I'm trying to think, is there anything else? Oh, I never told you all of my very pretentious, this is before I went to college.
Oh,
I
yes,
was
please.
reading Well, I got an English prize from the fabulous teacher, English teacher I was very lucky to have, called Miss Tracy, who was in Glengarra. And I got the English prize 1 year, and I chose, you were allowed to choose what you wanted. So I chose the collected works of George Orwell, thinking I'd better be. Yeah, I know. So I was reading,
Great.
Down and Out in Paris and London and Keep the Aspid Istra Flying and Animal Farm and all of those, and feeling very knowledgeable. And then carried on then in my final 2 years reading like André Gide and Flaubert and,
Oh, lovely.
And was rather pretentious. We had a literary society and we read, Khalil Gibran. However, in that time, also read Catcher in the Rye, which was just, iconic. The Handmaid's Tale, I consider myself really lucky to have been kind of young when The Handmaid's Tale came out, to be handmaid
Yes.
when Handmaid's Tale came out, because that was just, I can still remember reading that and just going, oh my God, like it was just so gripping. And then also I considered myself really lucky that to be there when Ian McEwan wrote The Cement Garden, because, and or even just for Ian McEwan, because it was just a whole new way of looking at writing, I think,
Do you know I haven't read that? Jill, The
Oh,
Cement Garden. I've read
yeah.
other Ian McEwan, but I don't think I've read The Cement Garden. Great.
Well, it is chilling and brilliant, and yeah, just so effortless writing. You don't feel that you're being kind of, you don't feel that you're reading even. You're just straight in the
In
world.
there. So this was, when you say pretentious, but it sounds gorgeous. That's a lovely reading list. I mean, I suppose like if it were today, people would say you're being performative, if you were like sitting around with your copy of The Bell Jar or something, check it out. I am intellectual, but
Well,
that's
I suppose I'm thinking more pretentious because I don't know that I understood them. I mean,
Oh, I
reading
see.
like Madame Bovary, and people, when people write about Madame Bovary now, I think, I don't know if I got that. I just was like, as far as I was concerned, she was just cheating on her husband or something. Would she not get caught? Like, I don't know that I know for sure I didn't get it on all the levels that
Sure.
one should get it. But yeah, so in that way, I think. But also, they were nice and short. There was that too.
So I want to ask you as well, before we get to the book being left in the burning house, if you're going to choose one, I don't know if you're going to choose one of those, about a book that perhaps has been with you through more difficult times or at a particularly difficult time.
Well, that's kind of interesting. So there was a book that really helped at a difficult time. So, or I mean, it should have been a wonderful time of great rejoicing, because I had had my first child,
Oh, yeah.
and she's fabulous, and everything was great, and everything's gone. However, looking back at that time now, I realize I was probably quite depressed because people would come and, isn't this great? And they'd give me presents and everything be brilliant and how wonderful it is. And all I could think was I was just hit with this overwhelming sense of responsibility. And I had no access to the joy of what it should be like. So in that way, I suppose I was very sort of low. And one of the things it meant is like I didn't read probably for about 5 years. No way could I pick up a book. In fact, I didn't even pick up the newspaper because why would you do that? Because any minute you'd have to put it down, and I needed to be focused on her. So in 1998, so at that stage of my, she would have been maybe three. Is that right? Yes, she would have been eight. Oh, and she would have been three. A great friend, Jackie, a teacher pal of mine who we'd met in teacher training college, gave me the book, The American Short Story,
Oh,
the Granta book.
brilliant.
Which was, and what I loved about it, and I did read them because, but what I loved about it was two things. Number one, that she knew me well enough to know that, like, you want to read something, and it's quite an imposing looking book. That it's like about that thick, it's sort of 4 inches thick, and it has, amazing short stories. And I don't even know half the writers, but you could just dip into it, and you could just read a couple of pages, and if you wanted, then if it grabbed you, you'd carry on. I think it was more the act of faith that, look, reading is not gone now. When I heard now in recent years about the Tired Mummy Book Club, set up, I mean, I just think absolutely brilliant. That's one of the amazing things about Instagram and that kind of community and all of the people, and Nurse Fancy Benz and all the people who have their kind of book clubs. Because that is a great way to get yourself reading and to be chatting to other people and bonding and stuff. So I love that, but there was none of that. So that was really important, and that got me back reading. And in terms of a book that I go back to, so I actually don't really read any fiction again. I don't think I've read anything again. I don't know why. I just, or if I did, it was by accident. You know, I think there's just too many books. And also, even if I loved it, I don't know if I want to kind of take it apart and look at it. But there's a book I go back to for writing over and over and over, just because it always gives something. And that is The Emotional Craft of Fiction by Donald Mass.
Ooh.
Because it just, there's always something in it. He goes through, you know, well-known writers or famous books, whatever, and he'll take a little piece out to discuss, and you kind of look at how you were drawn into that, how you were, how the author got you into the story. And he, you know, it's wide ranging, there's like modern pieces and ancient pieces. But I mean, I've earmarked bits of it, but usually if I'm stuck, I'll just open it anywhere and there'll be something in it that makes me think, oh yeah. And it's not that I copy it, but there'll be some way of a little twist and going, right. And then you start thinking about your story differently. So, but in terms of a story or a book that I would go back to if I was feeling low, I would, any book will do that for me.
Yeah.
Any book will still my brain or calm the anxiety or get me out of the thing. So I wouldn't need, you know, I don't need.
You don't need to revisit something or to go back into a familiar, like, mindscape or anything like that.
Yeah.
No, I can relate to that. I can. Yeah. Now, I don't know, Jill, if you want to answer this or not. So fine, if you don't want to. It's about a book you would leave in your burning house.
A book I would leave in my burning house. Well, I thought long and hard about this. And of course, there's nothing, as I'm sure you know now, there is nothing like writing a book to make you just applaud everybody who ever writes a book. Oh my God, when I look back to some, there was one person I reviewed when I had a little job reviewing, and I did a kind of could do better review. And oh, every time I sit down to write, I think, yeah, you know, how dare you? But anyway, so I think I'm going to kind of slightly go around the question and say, so in those years of the pretentious fifth and sixth years, as I was reading my French stuff, I was writing a lot of poetry.
Okay.
And I have my essays. So I have those books with my wonderful poems about how people didn't understand me. And, you know, I don't know what they were. But anyway, my musings on life. So and I don't know why I've kept them. I found it very difficult. So if the house was on fire, I'm afraid I would just go, yeah, no, it's time to let those go. So the poems could
very good and very diplomatically done as well. Yes, they can go up in flames. And then something that you would save from the house that isn't a person or a beloved animal.
Yeah. Now, well, of course, yes, you've got your beloved animal. And then I feel as well, I mean, everybody would probably, I probably should save my laptop, because I never am good at knowing whether I back things up to the cloud or not. And I'm always worried about, you know, thing crashing. I think it has to be photos, because my mum died 20 years ago. So she was only in her 60s when she died. So I have a photo of my mum with my girls, which is just very dear to me. And then I have a photo of my dad. So my dad, he was a very charismatic man, as you should be if you're a cleric, I think. And he really enjoyed the kind of that whole kind of role, because the clergy person has a, you know, the rector has a kind of a role in the community, you know, as a character. So he became even more of a character and lived into his 80s. And he had silver hair and a silver beard and thought himself gorgeous and wore a ring on every finger. I kid you not. And often used a hairspray to keep his shock of silver hair in space.
Oh, I love it.
So I have a photo of him clutching. There was one day we were, I brought him to a medical appointment, and the taxi, wheelchair taxi, he had Parkinson's, but the wheelchair taxi didn't come to pick him up. And he also had diabetes, and I was really worried that he was going to have a hypo. So I went into a little hotel near the Beacon Hospital, and a big hotel, and got him a gin and tonic. So I will show you this for, I know you can't see it, but I shall describe it for you. So he's clutching the largest fishbowl, you know, the fishbowl gin and tonic, which he shouldn't have been having anyway. So I'd have to save the picture of my mum with my kids and dad with the gin and tonic. And I suppose if I had my phone already with me, obviously my dog Kevin and my dog the predeceased Kevin Solo, they're there, and the
They're
cats.
there.
But
Oh,
got to be all those ones
that's lovely,
are
Jill. All saved, all happily
all
saved.
all.
So I just want to move on to your novel, and I didn't realize it was a number three in a series. So I read it as a standalone,
Great,
or I listened to
great.
it,
You
as
have
I
to
have to
say that
say,
again. Can
yes,
be read as a
100%. And I listened to it as well. I have to say, the narrators on the audiobook
Oh,
are fantastic.
aren't they? Yeah, they are absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
And so, like, I do, before we get into, like, in quotation marks, what it's about. What we were talking about earlier, and like some of the things that you touched on fairy stories and the kind of interpretation of that. A lot of the themes were there. I loved some of the things. To me, for me, it was all about the characters. It was all about Gemma, and I loved her. I loved how complex and how sort of, how frustrated I was with her, but how relatable she was, you know, particularly with, I suppose, just for anyone who hasn't read it, I'm sure nearly everyone listening probably has read it at this stage. But so Gemma, would you call her an influencer? She's not really. I mean, she's sort of forced to be nearly, like, she's an
Yes.
influencer. She's on Instagram all the time. She has this beautiful, well, she is beautiful herself, but she's
Yes.
also got a persona, I suppose, for the want of
Yes.
another word, online. And you know, it's her packaged life. It's her beautiful, my
Yes.
beautiful life, basically. But it's not. It's not. It's not
It's
at all like that.
yes, yes. I suppose, yeah, because so Gemma, well, thank you for saying those lovely things about it. And Gemma really, you know, I never know really where that book started, kind of Gemma, but it started with Gemma in Dunleary and, you know, her seafront mansion. So everything, she has this enviable life, or people think she has, and she, you know, she belongs so perfectly in this, and the beautiful house and the beautiful life and her beautiful clothes and her little boy and her, you know, adventurous, handsome husband and everything. That's where you first meet her, you know, in that situation. But even before we've met her, you know, she has a family tragedy. You know, her beloved older brother went missing 18 years previously. And I love the idea of kind of conjuring up this. And again, I suppose, not that I went to 21st in the Yacht Club in Dunleary, but when we were in the school, we would walk down on a Sunday, we would walk down to the seafront. And there was the rules, things like, you know, that you couldn't you weren't allowed to be seen in your school uniform eating, you know, that kind of thing. So Dunleary has this kind of proper, glamorous, beautiful side to it. So Max, her older brother, had disappeared 18 years previously, and the story kicks off with the discovery of his body. His body rises to the surface. It's washed ashore after a storm. And where everybody had presumed that, you know, the pressure of the Olympics, because Max was a sailor and he was going to race 49ers in the Olympics of that year. So everybody presumed that the pressure of the Olympics had proved too much for him and that perhaps he'd taken his own life or run away. But as soon as his body is discovered, then the evidence from the body shows you that, in fact, he met a violent end. So that's where the story begins. And Gemma's life begins to unravel, and I always kind of say it's a kind of a wide on it. I mean, you know, the clue is in the title, and Gemma, you know, you're not going far. Kind of like, I wonder was it so and so? I wonder was it so and so? It's called The Night I Killed Him. So Gemma believes herself responsible for his death. Gemma, you know, did something bad in the past, and I was just really interested in seeing, trying to get her to escape from the two prisons, I suppose, the prison of her own mind, of her guilt and her grief, And the other prison, which is this, you know, elaborate cage that she's living in, where we all think she's having a wonderful life, influencing people and just, you know, living the dream. But actually, she's not.
And that's the most interesting thing to me, thing to me about the book is her sort of gradual unraveling or slash embracing and accepting, you know, that sort of the dual thing that's going on, and it's all mixed up and she's trying to hold it all together, you know, holding it all together, and, you know, in the public facing side of her. And actually, what did you say? You said something earlier about, oh, like she lives in South Dublin. I think at some point, was it Conliffe says to her, that's her husband, says to her, you know, you live in coastal South Dublin in the most, you know, you're the envy of the country.
Yes.
Like
yes.
you've everything on your doorstep and she just wants to go away quietly and just get away from it all and go to a little cottage somewhere and just shut it all out. But she can't, you know, you really get that sense that she's just constantly on the brink.
Yes, yes, and exactly. And imagine, you know, so great is her torment and so great is the pressure of being visible and being visibly happy all the time. There's a very deep psychological thing. Mm. But anyway, but so difficult that is to live with means that she would walk away from the stunning seafront mansion. She would walk away and hide in a little, you know, in the back end of nowhere. You know, she wants to escape. But, you know, and I suppose as well, people I suppose need to read the book to the end to see, but like you can't always escape.
That's the thing. You really feel her sense of kind of, she's just trapped in this, you know, because of her own sense of guilt and everything else. But also, you know, she has a little boy, she has a family, she's again, don't want to give too much away here, but even her own marital situation is so difficult.
Yes.
But to me, as a sort of recovering people pleaser, I really related hard to a lot of that. She doesn't want to be a people pleaser anymore. But it's sort of almost in her DNA. And again, she meets someone, I can't remember if this is a friend or where she met. And, you know, she's trying to remind herself, people can be nice. People can be real. People can be honest. You know, they're not everything is fake and insincere.
Yes,
but she's sort of almost got herself into the world where, you know,
where nothing is real. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And I was quite interested as well in the idea that she's so isolated that this online world of, you know, as if your people who are your followers are your friends. But actually, in her case, they are her friends, because they're the closest things to the friends she had, because she's, you know, she hasn't had an opportunity. She hasn't had the freedom to really, you know, self-actualize and have friends herself. So I liked that idea as well, that it's not always just about flogging your thing, that some of it is about connection, you know.
Yes, that's interesting. You have she is the brand and has to be a brand, and yet also there's some genuine, and it kind of encroaches on real life, shall we say, some point. So, you know, it's like, wow, it's not just fake.
No, I loved writing that book. I mean, some of it obviously was hard to write, and even hard to write, even for me, hard to write, because I knew what I had to do. But I just so enjoyed writing it. And I did a lot of research, and I went, you know, I went down, I kind of researched the sailing, the boats. So I loved the physicality of that world.
Yes.
And then, you know, I went out then with, I went not out in the lifeboat, but I went out to life. Guard hut and saw their searching patterns and all of the stuff that they do. And again, I'm just blown away by the drama and the real drama, the real rescue, and people who put their lives on the line to rescue people they don't even know, you know. So
there's a genuine, I mean, you evoke a genuine kind of fear and respect of the ocean. Like there really is a genuine, oh my god, like it's terrifying at points, and absolutely you know,
that's because I have my own terror. I love the sea and learn to swim, blah blah blah, but I find the ocean terrifying. And in nightmares, I don't know, people, I presume everybody has the drowning nightmare, but you know, any of those shows that start with, you know, the waves coming over and the person trapped underneath, and the idea, was that film recently about those people who do the diving, like,
the free diving.
Oh my god, you know, it's absolutely terrifying. Water, black water, Dark
Yes.
water terrifies me.
Well, you're doing a good job of it right now.
No, sorry.
I know, but it is. But there is that, even like when little Ferdy is learning to swim, and there is like and then, yeah, you really feel. But there's a joyous swimming part in the book as well. A real
Yes.
release, a real sense of here I am.
Yes. And I suppose then that's, I suppose, like all these things, there's so many layers, isn't it? You know, if you do face your fear, you know, you will feel better. So there's the fear hanging over you, and a very sensible part of you that says, "No, I'm just not going to do that. Why do I need to do that? I don't need to swim." But from her point of view, you know, she does need to, and it's a wonderful opportunity for her. And in that way, you can, I maybe wanted to sort of show, you have all these people doing their sea swimming and they're hopping in freezing temperatures, completely exhilarated by the coldness and the risk, I suppose, and yeah, just the physical shock to the system, you know.
And I think as well, to me, again, this is just my personal reading of it. It was as much about finding a friend, a real friend, as all of the other things, and the extremely nail-biting plot, and Laura and Niamh, who are brilliant. I mean, like, I'm really glad now I can go and read two more books
Oh,
with
great.
them in it. So,
Yeah.
but about friendship, what friendship really is, and about, you know, there was another great line. It was like, you can't, you know, without real honesty, proper 100 honesty, you can't have a good friend if you're not
Yes.
willing to be totally honest, not just show the best side of yourself or the
Yes.
polished bits.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I suppose that's so important to me, and you know, again, it's not that I set out to do that, but when you know yourself, once you're writing, they're let loose in the world, and what is going to save them, or who is going to save them, or what can bring them something, even, you know, even when their life is fractured and bad things have happened, and you can't unlive them, they have happened, but a friend will help you through that, and a friend will have had other things, you know, we're all. You know, that happens to us all. We're all hurt. We all have loss. We all have bad things. But, you know, what matters is how we, I don't know, relate to each other and help each other.
And when you were, I mean, I know endings are everything, really. How can I just ask you, from a writing perspective, how many different endings did you sort of have, or like, did you like, were you very right? I did. Were you Did you know, right, this is how it's going to end, or did you were there lots of different possibilities?
In terms of how it ends, there was no other ending for that story. I've another story I've written since that I've changed the ending, so I couldn't say that I always know the ending, because I don't always. In that ending, I had great fun, and in that way, it's because because it's a three-hander, so you have three people talking, you know, talking to you. So that meant I could keep the tension up by hopping from person to person to person, and you're going, hang on, and so it meant I could leave the reader in suspense. And I always say this because, you know, because I only kind of realized it myself, but when I was running the ballet school, I had like 120 or 30 kids in a school. We do this big show every 3 years and hire a theater, and you know, I've got 150 kids to get on and off a stage and tell stories with no words. Now, even if they're well-known stories, but to me, when I'm marshalling the troops at the end of a book I'm writing, well, to me, to be just marshalling Laura, Niamh, and Gemma is a hell of a lot easier than, you know, 40 kids in the Ugly Duckling ballet or whatever. And it's a similar thing. It's like, I'll put them over there so that the reader can see that's happening, and I'll, you know, you give them their roles and move them around. So in that way, it's like choreography. It's just moving people around, and I suppose the physicality, you know, again, some of the dance teaching would help with that. You're kind of like, where are people standing? So I hope it was visceral, because, you know, physically, the physicality of it is very important. I don't want it to be believable, you know.
Yes, very, very much visceral, very visual, and yeah. I'm just in awe of how you can kind of, I don't know, I really the it, choreography is the right word. I think with all crime writing, I'm always kind of, I just don't know
Yeah, well, Well, it's funny, and look, I mean, I know I did a writing course at summer school a few years ago with Jake Arnott, who writes well, he writes different things, but he's a great writer. And he talked about sending his troops that your words are like the troops going over the top into battle, and you get them all ready, but once you know, you have to line them up and then let them go. So I suppose you talk about what, yeah, where you see them, but I see it as if you're watching a show and I'm putting the people in the places where you can see them, and you know, like one of those complex stages where you know you can see a couple of different things at once. So that's what I'm trying to do, just put them there. What do you need to see? I try not to think about it too much because I'm not a great plotter, so I have to just, you know, see
Well,
what
I
you
have
see
to
with them.
say the plot is amazing, so I have to
Oh,
disagree
thank
with that
you. Oh, thank you.
on that one. But are you going to read for us from the
Yeah,
night I could?
I thought, sure, look, I couldn't possibly miss the opportunity for a tiny bit of shameless self-promotion. I was just going to read the prologue of The Night I Killed Him, the little
Very
bit,
good.
because this image is kind of where it started. I really feel I saw this. So this is the beginning of the little few lines of the prologue of The Night I Killed Him. The last fragment of rope, barely a strand, perishes, consumed by a microscopic marine organism with an unpronounceable name, if it even has a name. As it does, the body begins to rise, no longer tethered in its dark water coffin. It rises from the ocean floor face down, limbs hanging, arms spread like a blessing, a water angel. Fragments of sea-rotted fabric are borne away in the currents to be nibbled by curious fish. The belt of rope sways umbilical in the vast marine womb. The boy is going home.
You've been listening to the wonderful Jill Perdue, whose novel The Night I Killed Him is out now with Penguin. See you all next time.